development, and we're going to have public hearings on three bills this morning. First up is House Bill 2253. Barry, do we have a sign-up sheet?
Mr. Chair, are you going to do work sessions too, or just hearing?
Probably just a hearing today. Ellen, if you would, before I call the witnesses up, if you please give a summary of House Bill 2253.
Thank you, Chair Whip, members of the committee. House Bill 2253 consolidates existing language in statutes that both authorizes and limits the investigative authority of the Bureau of Labor and Industries Commissioner, the Wage and Hour Commission, and the State Apprenticeship and Training Council. It also expands the ability of these agencies to seek court enforcement of their investigative subpoenas. Currently, there are a number of statutes that deal with the authority that BOLI has to investigate cases, and what they've done is consolidated that language that's scattered throughout the statutes into Title 51, which is the authorizing statute for BOLI.
Thank you very much. We have Commissioner Dan Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and pleased to be here before you today to talk about House Bill 2253. And why we need this particular bill. Oregon, most Oregon regulatory agencies, including BOLI, have statutory authority to issue subpoenas to investigate compliance with laws they enforce and require production of evidence for contested cases. Oregon Administrative Procedures Act provides authorities for state agencies, including BOLI, to compel compliance with subpoenas for evidence in those contested cases by petitioning a state circuit court for enforcement. However, the APA does not provide authority for agencies to enforce compliance with investigative subpoenas. Most agencies, including the Department of Human Services, the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, the Department of Revenue, the Department of Justice, have specific statutory authority to petition state circuit courts to investigate their investigative subpoenas, but BOLI does not. As a result, it's necessary for BOLI to file a lawsuit against an individual or entity that fails to comply with the Bureau's investigative subpoena in order to ask a court to enforce it. This is really just a needless expense and a needless use of time and consumption of time. There's a recent example. This last spring, the Bureau investigated complaints from a petition signature gatherers alleging violation of state wage and hour law. However, in order to compel the signature gathering firm owner, Brian Platt, to turn over the payroll records, the Bureau was forced by its lack of subpoena enforcement authority to go to the circuit court on three different occasions to enforce its order. The Bureau was forced to pay the Department of Justice more than $7,000 for their work to get the subpoena enforced in court. The Bureau's ability to prosecute cases was delayed by 6 months during this process, and our investigator in the case had to spend over 85 hours pursuing Mr. Platt at an estimated cost of $2,859.47. to Oregon taxpayers. What really House Bill 2253 does is it provides authority for the Bureau and the State Circuit Court to compel obedience with the Bureau's subpoena. The Bureau's investigative authority is found in several different places in Oregon revised statutes. The amended bill clarifies that it will adopt internal procedures to for issuance of investigative subpoenas, which include the ability of a respondent to object to the legality of our investigative request. The Bureau needs this straightforward authority to petition state circuit courts to enforce for enforcement of our investigative subpoenas. Passage of 2253 will conserve the resources of both the Bureau and the court system. And I might point out that this very same bill, in its as Senate Bill 434, passed the Senate in the 2005 session on a 23-4 vote. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Commissioner Gardner.
Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. At one point you said amended bill. This bill hasn't been amended. Did you mean
it was amended last, Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart. I meant amended as it was amended last session.
Thank you. Do you believe this bill needs additional amendment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, no, I do not.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Yes, Representative Gerard.
Yeah, you mentioned that the case in here about the $7,000, and it was against people gathering signatures for petitions. I'm just kind of surprised that Bully would get involved in that sort of activity. Can you explain why that became an issue for Bully?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gerard, of course I can. Basically what had happened was these particular petition gatherers were being paid per signature, being paid in cash. They were not being paid, in some cases, the minimum wage. In many cases, when the particular individual involved with the company left the state, we had to pay out of the Wage Security Fund final wages to some of these signature gatherers. They are required to pay minimum wage. They are required to keep employee records, and they did not do so, and it took us months to enforce on that.
Well, however, I mean, it does seem to me that, you can pick and choose as to signature gatherers. There's liberal causes, there's conservative causes. What do you do for your effort to pick and choose which ones that you decide to chase after?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gerard, we are very much an enforcement agency that's complaint-driven. We don't pick and choose our cases. We don't go out and find problems. Unless there are complaints that are filed with us, we don't go investigate anything. And those complaints have to be by the particular employees, in this case, those signature gatherers that were underpaid.
Representative Dahl.
Yes, Commissioner Gordon. Could you give us some notion of whether agencies have subpoena power and what list you would be joining?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dahlem, the list I would be joining would be the Department of Human Services, the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, Department of Revenue, the Department of Justice, and that's just the ones that we're aware of.
Thank you very much.
Vice Chair Lynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you took them to the court, were you able to recover the cost of $6,000, $7,000 if you were able to win the case?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, we did have a judgment against them for improper record keeping, failure to pay final wages, and several others. However, because we were not able to act in a very swift manner, they moved to Nevada, and we have not recovered a dime from them yet. And I think that's really the point here, is that with most established Oregon companies, we wouldn't have a problem in the first place, and there'd be absolutely no necessity. It's really the short-term companies that fly from the state that we have most of the problems with.
Okay.
Please.
Thank you. And I need some education in the terminology. What's this subpoenas duces decom? What that means?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lynn, with me is my legal policy advisor, Marsha Olemiller, and I leave those questions to the attorneys.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Witt and members of the committee. My name is Marsha Olemiller. I'm the legal policy advisor for the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And subpoenas duces tecum refers to subpoenaing a person and to bring with them documents.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, I knew it was Latin. No, I'm kidding.
Further questions for the commissioner?
With that, it looks like we're done. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
I don't have anyone else signed up for the bill at this point. Is there anyone from the public that would choose to testify this morning? Not seeing anyone, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2253. And it's not our intent to move any of the bills that are scheduled here today. So if any of you were anticipating a work session, we're going to conduct that later. Okay. Next up, we have House Bill 2261. And Ellen, if you could please give us a summary.
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. House Bill 2261 modifies the membership of the State Apprenticeship and Training Council and establishes minimum qualifications for membership to the council. It also limits those who qualify on local councils as being a representative of employees. Currently, the council is composed of 10 members, and this bill would reduce that number to 8.
And I will open the public hearing. First up is Commissioner Gardner?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And with me is Steve Sims, the Director of the Minister of the Apprenticeship and Training Division. House Bill 2261, first let me start by telling you that Oregon has a long history of supporting apprenticeship and training. Oregon law was actually first adopted in 1931 and predates the first federal legislation on apprenticeship, the Fitzgerald Act, by 5 years. Currently, there are 7,126 apprentices registered in Oregon, and 4,254 employers are approved to train apprentices. The changes proposed in House Bill 2261 are intended to make the apprenticeship system more user-friendly for employers and apprentices alike. ORS Chapter 660 is the authorizing authority for registered apprenticeship in Oregon. The State Apprenticeship and Training Council established a task force in December of 2003 to review the statute and to suggest some improvements. The task force was composed of representatives from the building and construction trades and the industrial trades. It included members from both union and open shop organization, as well as urban and rural program sponsors. The changes in the statutes have been reviewed by the Apprenticeship Council and the apprenticeship community to develop consensus for these modifications. Most of the changes proposed in 2261 are merely housekeeping in nature. Changes have been made in improving grammar usage and clarifying terms used in an apprenticeship. For example, employers authorized to train apprentices have traditionally been called training agents. However, the term has never been defined in statute, so we have defined a training agent in House Bill 2261. The most important changes to 2261 involve the composition of the council and establish minimum qualifications for appointment to the council. The council has 11 members, myself, the labor commissioner, and 10 additional members appointed by the governor and confirmed by the state senate. Currently, 4 members represent industrial trades and 4 members represent construction trades and 2 represent the public industrial and construction trade members must be equally, or 2 represent the public, I should say. And industrial and construction trade members must be equally divided by members representing employers and members representing employee interests. In House Bill 2261, it retains the 4 council members from the building trades and eliminates the 4 members from the industrial and manufacturing trades. In their place would be 2 members representing non-building trades, occupations that have approved and registered programs with the council, 1 representing employer and the other representing employees. The two public members are retained and reducing the total appointed council membership from 10 to 8. The change really isn't proposed to diminish the importance of industrial and manufacturing trades, but to more accurately reflect the actual participation in registered apprenticeship. For more than a decade, the construction trades have accounted for more than 80% of apprentices registered with the council. The governor would retain the ability to appoint the industrial representatives to the positions that are not industry-specific. And the governor would also have the ability to appoint members from new and emerging high-growth occupations. As apprenticeships tries to expand beyond the building trades, this allows the council to gain some synergy with other state workforce initiatives. House Bill 2261 also establishes minimum requirements for representing an industry, trade, or occupation on the council. The council and the task force concluded that these requirements were necessary to ensure the council continues to represent the best interest of registered apprentices and ensures the growth of apprenticeship as a training method. By having council members with direct experience in a registered apprenticeship education or active relationship with workforce development systems, it'll also ensure that this happens. The council and the apprenticeship community supports these changes, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you very much. Steve, did you wish to make a statement?
Chairwood, no, nothing at this time. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions for our panel here? Yes, Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, you mentioned that this would more accurately represent and the existing makeup of the apprenticeship program and would help to expand it. I see how it does the first. I don't see how it does the second.
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, what it does do is it gives the governor the flexibility. Should we have emerging occupations go into apprenticeship and use the apprenticeship model? For instance, with the graying of America, the advent in technologies around the medical profession, if there were apprenticeships that started in that particular occupation, by making it more flexible and saying it's a non-construction trades appointment, it would allow for an appointment in that area.
Follow up, please.
Please.
thank you. I understand that reducing it from 10 to 8, however, takes away two of those flexible positions. It seems to me it would be better to leave it leave those two positions in and make those also flexible positions so that we could have room to add those. I mean, we're going to fill this. And then we're gonna have some new apprenticeship program in the medical profession, and we'd have to take someone off of the board to put someone on. It seems to me a good strategy here would be to make it 8 to 10 instead of fixing it at 8. It's just your comments on that.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think I'll let Mr. Sims comment on that. He was present during most of the debates when this was discussed.
Chair with Vice Chair Riley, thank you. Steve Sims, pardon me, the Administrator for the Apprenticeship and Training Division. The decision to reduce the size of the council was debated by the task force and by the full council in the course of determining what changes should be made. The exact point that you were made was raised, that perhaps we should keep the size of the council at 10, reduce the number of industrial seats to 2 total instead of 4, and use the other 2 seats to attract new and emerging industries. I think that it would be accurate to say that the consensus of the group discussion was that sometimes with a 10-member voting panel, of course with the Labor Commissioner it's the 11th vote, with a 10-member voting panel, sometimes debate and discussion became too unwieldy with 10 individuals, that it became too difficult to manage. Now, that was the belief of the council members the people on the task force. I think that they would certainly accept the judgment of the legislature if it was decided that no, we'd have a better deliberative body with 10 individuals instead of 8.
Follow up, please.
Please.
How many members were on this task force?
Chair Witt, Vice Chair Riley, on the task force there were three council members who were active participants in the task force, as well as the task force itself comprised of 12 individuals.
So 15 people, were they able to deliberate?
Vice Chair Riley, they were able to argue. I don't know if they ever got to true deliberation, but again, the point's well taken that it's six of one, half dozen of another. Do you get more diversity by having more people or more contention?
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, one thing I might point out is that the Labor Commissioner only has a vote in case of a tie, and in 4 years I've never voted yet. It's my goal never to do so.
I can understand that. Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just note for the record that after hearing the discussion of the deliberative capacity with large groups, that there are 60 of us.
And which side is that on?
I would leave that to the members.
Okay. Anything more for Mr. Sims or Commissioner Gardner? Seeing none, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
And again, I'm not seeing anyone else signed up for the bill. Please come forward.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Witt, committee members. My name is John Killen. I'm the executive director for the Independent Electrical Contractors of Oregon. Thank you for letting me speak, and I apologize for not signing up properly. IEC Oregon serves 150 electrical contractors in and around Oregon. These are generally small business folks. They range in size from just a handful of employees to well over 200. Along with our sister chapter down in Eugene and a affiliated Area 1 metro area electrical program, we administer well over 800 apprentices. We were unaware of the discussion regarding this council. We weren't invited. We didn't really know what was going on until the bill was printed. We've reviewed the bill. We do have a couple concerns, but not huge ones that we can't get over. At first glance, we agree. Councils, generally speaking, work a little better on a small scale. Shrinking them isn't necessarily a bad idea. We want to be inclusive. We want to have broad discussions on high concept policies, but we recognize that smaller councils have their financial and logistical benefits. And further, we agree that apprenticeship is the cornerstone of the construction industry. Our main concern is really about the qualifications. In the kind of final section of the main elements of the bill, it refers to that you have to be part of, you have to qualify two out of four items. And some of those are affiliation or membership in a trade association or a signatory organization. We don't feel that that should matter. We feel that if you have the experience and expertise, that should be enough. For instance, a business leader could not be a member of the council unless they had the favor of a group like mine. And if my board didn't like this person, they wouldn't get that favor. They wouldn't be noted as a representative. And we don't think that's quite probably right to insist that somebody pay us dues to get to serve on council. That's about the extent of our comments at this time. We think we can certainly talk out with the commissioner on these details. And we don't have any formal amendments at this time, but I'd be available for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Killam. Questions from the committee? Yes, Representative.
And just a follow-up, did they give you a reason that you were not invited to during these negotiations?
Chair Witt, Representative Grug, I until 5 minutes ago, I didn't know there was a task force.
Okay. Anything further? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anyone else from the public?
Morning, Bob. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bob Shiprock, Executive Secretary, Oregon Building Trades Council. Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to let you know that I've been working with Boley to have an amendment for this bill. Something has come up just recently that I didn't even know was legal. And what it is there's a glitch in federal or state law that allows a single employer to set up an apprenticeship program, one employer in the building trades, which flies in the face of what we try and do, both union and non-union, in trying to train our people, moving them around. Not every contractor does every phase of every craft. I mean, it's impossible. So what the amendment would do, and I'd be happy to work with the staff, is to, in the building and construction industry, you would have to join some type of a group program so that you have uniform curriculum, a pool of employers that the apprentices can work for and things like that. And it's one sentence long. Mr. Sims helped me draft the language, and I'll get it for you. But it would close a loophole that I didn't know existed, and we don't want to see it get started. It's really important to us.
Can well understand that. questions or comments? Yes, Representative Polby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Bob. So just to follow up on that, the problem with having a single employer be able to have their own apprenticeship program would be that they can have their own standards, their own rules, their own that really could undermine the overall skill of a trade. Is that a fair synopsis?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Colby, it even goes beyond that. You have to wonder, state law requires a minimum of, I think it's 144 hours of classroom training. How could a single employer hire teachers, have their own curriculum, and do the classroom training that's required by state law? You'd have to surmise that it won't get done. The other thing, the apprenticeship laws are not for the union, they're not for the employer, they're to protect the apprentice. Imagine being apprenticed, indentured to one shop. It would make life interesting for that apprentice, I think, in that there's really no ability to move on to another contractor. Maybe all you've done is, wire. I'm an electrician. You've wired apartments for 4 years, and you'd like to maybe see what a manufacturing plant looks like or something, And it just flies in the face of what we've tried to do in this state in apprenticeship, and again, I didn't even know it was allowed. So working with Boley to try and close it, but and you'd have to question what Mr. Holvey's saying. I mean, what's the skill level of this person should they graduate? I mean, typically contractors specialize in only one type of thing.
Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It occurs to me as we're listening to Bob describe this problem that in dealing with traditional educational institutions, there are a whole series of accreditation issues that deal with the issues that he's raised, the curriculum and standards and all of that. In the area of apprenticeship, what we have is the balance between among employers, employees, and the fact that we're dealing with large groups of businesses and groups of employees rather than that accreditation kind of program. And so therefore the issue that he raises goes right to the heart of apprenticeship. I think you used the word indenture.
Mm-hmm.
I thought we'd gotten rid of indentured servitude a couple hundred years ago, and obviously we don't want to go back to it.
Still around. The other issue I would mention, Mr. Chairman, I mean, you can think of all the scenarios. Not all contractors out there in a competitive environment, suppose they don't get some work and they're slow, they got to lay somebody off. I mean, this apprentice is supposed to be getting state-required hours of work. There is no work at that shop where it's bad weather. They have no option to go somewhere else. I mean, it's just, I won't belabor it, there's just a multitude of problems that we see with this glitch that we've discovered.
Representative Bell.
I think the term that I want to use in education, if you don't have a multitude of instructors, the term is inbred. In fact, you want instructors with many different experiences. Mm-hmm. That term comes to mind, and we're not interested in that.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm struggling with something, and I'm probably not seeing the whole picture, but the analogy with public education caught my ear, and this, we have exceptions. And we have homeschooling. It bothers me some that instead of looking at the actual quality of the apprenticeship that's being provided, we're talking about who's providing it. And that bothers me a little bit. Can you enlighten me on why that shouldn't bother me?
Well, Eva, I think, Mr. Chairman, Representative Riley, I'm not familiar with homeschooling. I really can't answer that, but I would assume that they have textbooks and things like that. My question would be, how would a single employer develop a curriculum to teach a craft on their own? I mean, why would other employers or perhaps employee organizations who have paid for this stuff to share it? I don't think that's going to happen. Then the whole question about the 144 hours of classroom training, who is this person that is all knowledgeable about an entire trade? I mean, that's all I can say.
Okay. Please. Thank you. Okay, well, I just wanted to put that out there because it was bothering me. You know, I see that there are some companies who would have the wherewithal to hire the instructors necessary to do the classes. It bothers me that we talk about who's doing the providing of the training when we're looking at it in what we've heard throughout this committee, what we're calling a train wreck of not enough folks out there to do the work. With our baby boomers retiring, we're not going to have enough people to do the work, and here we're saying we're not going to allow this somebody, and we don't even know who, to do training. And, you know, just because they want to call it an apprenticeship. And if they do the same training with the same quality instructors, I don't see why we would stop that.
Further questions? Yes, Representative Gerard.
Bob, were you invited to the discussions in the making of this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gerard, no, some of my affiliates were, however, that are active in the apprenticeship arena.
Are you happy with the rest of the bill?
Yeah. Yes, I am.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm following up with Representative Riley, and I understand his questioning, line of questioning to some degree, but I think that you really have to reiterate the point that Bob's made about having an industry set the standards and set the accreditation as such, or the certification for an industry, rather than having a single employer decide, by themselves, how the whole industry, what the standard should be for that trade, I guess, or that apprenticeship program, unless of course that industry is the or employer is the whole industry, which I'm not sure that exists anywhere. So I really think that at the having a group do this. We have community college associations. We have, many other instances of training and education standards being set by a group and not really any one individual employer. So just wanted to offer that.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate this discussion because I think it really goes to the heart of the apprenticeship programs as I understand them. And I'm absolutely, everyone I'm sure knows that I'm not an expert. But it occurs to me that even if, arguendo, a business was large enough and diverse enough within itself to provide the 144 hours of classroom training and some diversity of experience, I still believe that we would want apprentices to experience the way different businesses handle their operations. That a business of the size I'm talking about tends to become insular, developing its own standards and its own way of operating, just in the way it does business generally. If our journeymen are going to have the flexibility and the capacity to work for a number of different employers, they need to experience working in different settings with different management styles and different approaches to some of the same kinds of tasks. So I would expand, I think, Bob's argument that even if a business was big enough to provide all of those things on the books, I still would think it would be better to give an apprentice the experience of working for several different employers. I think there's a value in that all of its own, despite the possibility that some business might be large enough to comply with the formal requirements of the apprenticeship law.
Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to state for the record, I'm not opposed to what you're saying. I just wanted to have that discussion. I thought it was a discussion that needed to be held.
It has been a good discussion. And Bob, I just for the sake of kind of giving us a feel for some of the different things that your members do, compare with us maybe even the mode of dress between doing a high-tech job versus, pick one, an industrial job site or something like that. I mean,
Mr. Chairman, I'll speak only for my trade. I have a rule. I don't talk about other people's professions. It gets me in trouble. In the National Electrical Code, you have different what we call wiring methods, explosion proof, which we'll use in certain like grain elevators and things like that, down to house wiring, low voltage wiring, and everything in between, you putting in conduit. And that's why we went to a 5-year apprenticeship, and now even in my local, we're getting even more specific where people are concentrating more like in control work and things like that, where they're becoming more specialists instead of a generalist. The other thing that Representative Barnhart hit on a really good point. I mean, I'm trying to think of all the ramifications of what this amendment would deal with, and he's absolutely correct. I've worked for a lot of, residential shops, for instance, and they all are different. They do it different. It's a different management style, and you learn going through those various shops, and you make up your own mind which one works the best, and you adopt that, and so later on when you're running work for another contractor, you can pick and choose the management styles that you've experienced, and that's what makes the industry, productive. You're exposed to a lot of different ways of doing the same thing. A lot of different ways to get to the end.
Representative Dolan.
I think Bob might be able to help you out. A long time ago, we were very, very short of industrial engineers. So the Boeing Company would hire people off the street. And they broke that function down. You might be a programmer under the tutelage of an industrial engineer. And under the programmer would be a scheduler. And under the scheduler would be an equipment procurer. But your broad title was industrial engineer. But when you left the Boeing Company, your certificate meant absolutely nothing. Hmm. You couldn't work for anybody else. And I think that's what we're digging out here. If you're going to carry a title, that title has to have exactly the same meaning everywhere you go.
Right.
And you know that when a guy says, I'm an industrial engineer. He can handle that function top to bottom, side to side. And I think that's what happens when you become inbred. You can't do the whole job.
Well, I want to thank you so very much. This has been a great discussion.
Well,
in addition to your proposed amendment, and we'll be awaiting that.
And if I could talk to your staff about
getting
it drafted.
Please feel free.
I just wanted the committee to know that there was an amendment coming,
great.
So you are aware of it. Thank you very much.
And thanks so much for the education. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Sean Miller here today on behalf of the Associated Builders and Contractors and the Independent Electrical Contractors. And I was unaware of this loophole as well that would support Bob's amendment that is coming forth. I think this was a good discussion. I think Representative Riley raises a good point, because in many small businesses, you either have a son or a daughter who eventually you want to take over that business. And I think in that discussion, I think you were trying to raise a lot of that experience just comes through their family businesses, many of the businesses that I represent. However, I think having the group of employers as part of the apprenticeship program is something that actually my small businesses actually want. They want to keep those folks in their business, but they actually want to go out and learn experiences and be involved in a lot of different kinds of construction, residential, commercial, and they get those experiences through these the JTCs. And so, I think Bob raised a pretty good point, and even though I know a lot of them want to keep their sons and daughters within their group, and they give them very good experiences, I think it's the curriculum of the apprenticeship programs, I think, that Steve wanted to just focus on, that a lot of times the employers themselves would not be able to provide, because the curriculum is you learn a lot on the job, but you also learn a lot with the class time, the lab time and things like that, and especially in the electrical trade. And so it is that group of employers that makes the system work. And so I think you raise a really good point, but it is an advantage to the system to have those group of employers. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Very good.
Mr. Chair, committee member Steve Sims with the Apprenticeship and Training Division. I wanted to clarify one point and then talk a little bit about the academic instruction piece. The task force that the council commissioned in 2003 had representatives from the apprenticeship side of just about every type of program in the state. And I do believe what might have happened is the apprenticeship people may not have communicated, but we had representatives from Associated Builders and Contractors on this task force, and that information may not have gotten communicated to other sides. With respect to the education, the council feels it's important that when someone completes a program in a given occupation, be it carpenter, electrician, plumber, what have you, that anyone getting a State of Oregon journey card meets a minimal level of proficiency. I don't care if it's in Bend or Portland or Medford, union or non-union program, everyone needs to meet a certain level. So what we have for each occupation are statewide guideline education committees. Those committees sit down and say, what is the minimum academic guideline curriculum for every single program in that trade in the state? And they agree upon the type of classes that need to be taken. They develop a syllabus of classes that need to be taken. That then goes to the various apprenticeship committees in the state in that occupation, and then my staff goes out and says, now, where is your curriculum? What is your instructional method? So in many cases, in the case of IEC, ABC, most union programs, they have international organizations that develop curriculum. That is their job. In many cases, they send their instructors back to their headquarters to take classes and instructional methods, to take classes in the newest developments and innovations. So we go out there, my staff is a part of compliance, and say, what are you teaching? How are you teaching it? Is the delivery method sound? We make that check. In the case where there aren't large international organizations supporting the local apprenticeship committees, we then look to the community colleges. And the community colleges in most occupations have developed guideline that meets the minimum criteria for apprenticeship. So we do have a system. We do have a uniform system. It makes it very difficult for individual employers to come in and say, I'm going to teach this curriculum. Most apprenticeship classes, when they're presented by an industry organization or a union, are closed classes. You need to be members. So if I'm Joe's Contracting, I can't just jump in. The community college classes are frequently closed because those are contracted services. So where does that individual get their classes from? It would be very difficult to develop and deliver an adequate curriculum for an individual employer in a construction setting. On the industrial side, frequently, in the case of contractors like Boeing or Oregon Steel, they'll negotiate a contract with the community college to get it delivered for their 5-10 students. But in the construction side, it's going to be impossible to get those classes outside of the construction setting. And I hope that clears up any confusion about what our guidelines for curriculum are.
Questions for Sean or Steve? Sean, before you leave, as an employer group who's out there hiring the apprentices, how are we doing in terms of our education and training for apprentices in the state of Oregon?
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think I would defer to some of my colleagues in the back of the room who actually run those programs, but my understanding is I mean, these are top-notch programs, and, you know, from on the electrical side, you know, we have... I think our programs and comparably the union programs are do a very well good job of training our you know, the next generation of the construction force. Unfortunately, you know, we're not catching up with what's going to be happening with those folks retiring, and that's what our biggest fear is actually getting more and more people into the trades. And I'll tell you, if we have one worry, it's not how good we're training, it's that we can't get enough of them. And that's the problems that we're having getting folks out of the high school into the programs, because I think some, you know, the counselors aren't actually, you know, we don't feel doing a good enough job actually directing those kind of folks into our programs, even though I think we try to do the best we can. I think that's where we're falling short. If I were to say generally an apprenticeship is getting more and more of these people into the trade, because if we don't, you know, the next 10 years could be a real problem in the state.
Sean, I'll just tell you that I'm convinced that Representative Dolan's got some pretty good ideas in that regard, and I think we're going to be hearing more about it here later on. So,
would you keep your cards a little closer to your chest?
Thank you both very much. I appreciate it. Anyone else wish to testify on House Bill 2261? Seeing none, no one else, I'm going to close the public hearing on that bill and open a public hearing on House Bill 2412. And let's see here. We have a couple of people signed up.
Mr. Chair, did you want a summary of this before we...
Oh, yes, please. Thank you, Vice Chair.
Thank you, Vice Chair Riley, Chair Witt, and members of the committee. House Bill 2412 directs the State Apprenticeship and Training Council to adopt rules establishing a minimum numeric ratio of journeymen to apprentices. Specifically, it prohibits more than one journeyman for one apprentice, but it allows more than one apprentice per journeyman.
And Steve Sims, you're up again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Stephen Sims, Administrator for the Apprenticeship and Training Division. And on behalf of Chair Gardner, I'd like to testify and express the division's opposition, or the Bureau's opposition, to House Bill 2412. House Bill 2412 amends ORS 660.120 to require the State Apprenticeship Council to adopt rules for establishing minimum ratios of journey workers to apprentices. Currently, the State Apprenticeship Council has discretion in evaluating how many apprentices in comparison to the number of journey workers are on the job. And that's important. One of the essential aspects of registered apprenticeship is it's supervised on-the-job training. And it's the council's job currently to determine what the appropriate level of supervision is. House Bill 2412 would prohibit the council from approving ratios requiring more than one journey worker per apprentice. It would permit the council to adopt minimum ratios that would allow one or more journey workers per worker per apprentice. The way most ratios of apprentices to journey workers work right now, in almost all trades, you can have one apprentice for the first journey worker on the job. That's called a one-to-one ratio. In most trades, you can have one-to-one for the first two apprentices on the job. And in some, it goes even higher, one-to-one up to the first three. After the second or third apprentice, however, the ratio normally gradually increases. So in some cases, for the second apprentice, it might be you'd need two journey workers to put a second additional apprentice on the job. And so it kind of graduates upward for that. And there are a number of reasons for that. ORS 660.1261 requires the council to establish job site ratios consistent with proper supervision, training, safety, and continuity of employment. And each of those things has a different component. Proper supervision is self-evident. What ratio will ensure the best teaching for that apprentice on the job? Training, again, what is the appropriate training ratio? Safety is critical. Particularly in the licensed trades, plumbing and electrical, and I'd say in all the trades, operating engineers. You do not want to have young men and women who are not adequately trained running up around a job site without having adequate supervision, someone, an experienced hand saying, this is good, this is bad. And finally, continuity of employment. One of the problems with, and what's being proposed by House Bill 2412 is that you could have a situation where you could have three, four, five apprentices per journey worker. Well, continuity of employment, what happens when that one journey worker is sick or takes the day off? You've put two, three, four apprentices out of work. That's why, by statute, the council has discretion in establishing what the ratio should be. House Bill 2412 would prohibit the council from establishing ratios consistent with proper safety, supervision, and continuity of employment and endanger the safety of apprentices due to the potential of having multiple untrained, unskilled apprentices on a job site with a single journey worker. House Bill 2412 disregards that, pursuant to ORS 660.155, most ratios are collaboratively set by statewide joint committees composed of representatives from every apprenticeship committee in a given trade or occupation in the state. A few minutes ago, I talked about our statewide curriculum committees. We also have statewide guideline standards committees, and it's similar to the curriculum committee. We go to all of our apprenticeship programs in a given occupation, let's say carpenters. We get all of those programs statewide in a room together and say, you've decided what is the uniform curriculum or the minimum mandatory curriculum. Now let's talk about the work processes and the degree of supervision. Can you all agree on what is the appropriate level of supervision? And those groups meet and they debate. And then they come to the council with a proposal. Well, we're proposing a ratio of one-to-one for the first apprentice and one-to-two thereafter, for example. In most cases, the council agrees with the consensus of that committee. Now, in some cases, the council says, no, we really think in exercising our judgment a higher ratio or a lower ratio may be important. But basically, the council takes the input from industry and makes a decision, as it's statutorily required to do. So this takes away the council's ability to make that balancing test and weigh it and says, no, everything's either going to be one-to-one or one journeyman and multiple apprentices to it. And we don't feel that that's in the best interest of training. In other cases, ratios are collectively bargained. A collective bargaining agreement might say our ratios are one-to-one for the first and one-to-one for the second. Well, that creates a conflict with House Bill 2412, which states that, no, everything's going to be one-to-one or a higher ratio. I don't know how we resolve that problem. And finally, our opposition is based on the fact that House Bill 2412 sacrifices safety and quality of instruction in exchange for increasing the number of apprentices on the job site. Now, in appearing before this committee before, we've talked about the need to increase the number of individuals in the trade to make up for our coming skill shortage, but that doesn't mean throwing people out there unprepared and undersupervised. It has to be done in a logical fashion. Therefore, the Bureau respectfully opposes House Bill 2412, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify before you today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for Steve? Not seeing any. Thanks very much. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
I'd like to call up Bob Hall, please. Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Hall. I represent Portland General Electric. PGE has some strong concerns with the direction that House Bill 2412 is taking the apprenticeship program. As you all know, that our linemen are out there every day working on and around live voltages. To allow more than one apprentice up to one journeyman is a very strict safety problem for us. In fact, before we can have one apprentice on the job, we require two journeymen wiremen to be there. I am a journeyman wireman, not a lineman, so I'm having trouble sometimes with this. But we need two people out there that really understand the system. Some person might be up in a bucket truck, another one's the apprentice someplace else. You cannot provide the adequate supervision to provide safety. The other issue is quality training. And I think that has been talked about a lot here today, and so I'm not going to beat that point to death. We believe the apprentice is an apprentice for the reason of learning their trade. The term journeyman is a very, very old term. It goes back, you know, to the Renaissance period and even before. The idea of being a young person, in those days it was a young man, would apprentice himself to a servitude to a journeyman in a craft, complete his craft, and once he became qualified and proficient, he was told to leave the city in which he was trained. He was to journey away from, hence the the history of the term journeyman. So it's the very well-trained workforce that we're talking about. If you'll allow me, I'd like to take my hat off from PGE and put my Bob Hall hat on. I am a licensed general journeyman electrician. Well, I was until January this year. I'm a little long in the tooth now to be out there competing with these young guys carrying my tool belt. So I've kind of left my license lapse this year. But I've gone through the electrical apprenticeship program. I am a general journeyman. I've been a journeyman. I've also been in supervision. And I can't stress strongly enough the importance of the training that these apprentices get when they come through the program. Once a apprentice turns, the end of the electrical apprenticeship, they take a test and are given a license by the state of Oregon as a general journeyman. At that point, they can leave their employers and go out and offer their services to the public. And once that person steps away from that initial environment, the public has no way of really knowing what kind of a training they've got behind it. The electrical program requires, the state standard requires 144 hours per year, which you said, plus 8,000 hours, 2,000 hours a year, 8,000 hours for actually working on the jobs. The apprenticeship program is a combination of schooling and learning the skills of the trade. And so, with that, if you have any questions, I'd be glad to attempt to answer them.
Bob, thanks very much. It's great to see you here today. Any questions? Yes, Representative Polvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know that I really have a question, but perhaps a follow-up statement to Bob's testimony. You know, having being a journeyman carpenter myself and having had apprentices to try to keep track of and watch, it is a huge safety issue if you're not able to watch somebody in a construction setting, because construction is a very dangerous occupation. I think not too many people would argue that. And there's another aspect of it that hasn't, maybe been alluded to, but, in another committee that I happen to be on, we're dealing with some huge problems with quality of construction and and the effect of that on consumers is has really been huge. And, you know, we have to have people out there watching that quality, too. And how would an apprentice really have the training and the skills developed to ensure that the job's being done right and in a quality manner? That's a huge concern. So I appreciate his statements and concerns about this bill. I share them. Thank you.
Not seeing anyone else. Bob, thank you very much for coming today. Appreciate both yours and PGE's efforts in making sure that we get this right.
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee.
I don't have anyone else signed up, please.
Good morning again, Chair Witt, committee members. Again, I apologize for not signing up properly. I didn't catch on to the one-page system this morning. John Killen to represent the Independent Electrical Contractors of Oregon. There's probably some assumption in the crowd that IEC requested this bill because we did in 2005. We did not request this bill this year. But I thought it was important to come up, give some background, tell you what did happen after the 05 session. As Oregon came out the long recession in late 2004 and early 2005, we saw a tremendous boom of construction that's still going today. When I gave testimony on the original bill, workforce shortages had begun in areas like Bend and Medford and were starting to creep into other areas. Since then, they swept across Oregon just like they did a lot of other states. Just about all my members have struggled for the last 2 years to hire enough qualified workers to fill the demand of the jobs that they had. At the same time, we're facing an aging workforce. It's already been discussed, and we know that the baby boomers will be hitting retirement age this year, or the first group of them. Our goal in 05, and still to some extent, is to increase the number of apprentices by increasing the ratio and bring more individuals into the what we like to call the earn while you learn system. The 2005 bill failed, of course, but after the session, the Commissioner Gardner and Mr. Sims stayed true to their word and helped gather all of the inside electrical apprenticeship programs to discuss the ratio. The group decided to adopt a standard of three journeymen to two apprentices, or journey persons to two apprentices, with a rounding up factor. That's actually one of the matrices I passed out. Without seeing it on paper, it's kind of hard to imagine how those numbers work. The group also agreed that this ratio would be based on a given work site, not a company-wide basis. This slightly odd ratio took some time to decipher, but as you can see, we were able to put it into a medium that we could broadcast and companies could understand. The plan to increase the apprenticeship ratio worked. We saw major growth in apprenticeship last year at a crucial time for the industry, a huge boom in our programs. Most of our members are continuing to work at that peak ratio, the new 3-2, many complain that they'd like a few more out there, largely because they can't find enough journeymen to fill the workload. Again, IEC Oregon did not request this current bill, but we appreciate the opportunity to talk about apprenticeship and workforce needs. The reality is that the workforce does need more trained journey persons and will continue to need more for the next decade. With that, I've already given you the copies. Thank you for your time, and I'm available for questions.
John, thank you very much. Representative Dolan.
In essence, what you're telling us, the problem that 2412 wants to fix is fixed.
I think that IEC would still prefer a 1-to-1 ratio in the electrical field, but the 3-to-2 gets pretty close, at least for small shops. It's what we negotiated out, and it's close enough for the time being, though we would appreciate time with Boley officials to maybe talk about going to the 1-to-1 someday. It is a process that should go through the Apprenticeship Council.
No need for the legislation.
No.
Thank you.
John, thank you very much. We appreciate your candor. Any other members of the public? Not seeing anyone. That will conclude the public hearing. I'm going to close it on House Bill 2412. And committee members, I don't see that we have any other business. Yes, Representative.
Just one announcement. On the way home last Friday, I stopped in one of the apprenticeship programs at Gresham. And, Mr. Chair, you've been toying with the idea of visiting an apprenticeship program. I would strongly recommend it for this committee. In fact, they offered us a place to hold our committee meeting. I think the things... I left there very excited and enthusiastic, and would certainly like the rest of the committee the advantage of seeing how significant these programs are.
Representative Gollum, I think that would be a very beneficial for all of us, and as soon as we get through most of our bills, I'm going to see if we can't schedule a trip like that. Not seeing anything else. Ellen, if you'd give us a preview for Friday.
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. On Friday, February 23rd, this Friday at 8 a.m. in Hearing Room C, you all will be having a joint public hearing on gambling and the possible establishment of a gambling task force. And the joint committee will be with the Human Services Committee. It will be here in Hearing Room C. And then you'll have a brief adjournment and a possible work session on House Bill 2519, which establishes a task force on gambling in Oregon.
Thank you very much. And with that, we stand adjourned.
It would be interesting next time.